Welcome back, everyone, for the second part of our call today, or our seminar today, which is detoxification. We already went through immune system. So detoxification is a subject that's near and dear to my heart because it's what I discovered way back when I was not feeling well and was struggling to get my health back. I discovered that I was toxic. And when I incorporated detoxification into my life, my health changed, my life changed, everything changed. Even my career changed because I decided this didn't need to be such a well-kept secret and I wanted to share it with the world. So I love talking about detoxification. Many of you have been through the Green Cleanse program, but there's more than just doing a week-long Green Cleanse. That is meant as an intro kind of cleanse. It's a cleanse where we're just limiting foods and enhancing through food, but there are a lot of other things you can do to deepen the detoxification practice. And we're going to talk to you about that. Again, similar to the way I presented the immune system, I would like to present this in a way so that you really get it. You really own it. You really understand phase one and phase two of the liver and the various foods and supplements and herbs and amino acids that affect it. And that you're able to easily answer questions when people ask you and easily guide people through. And we're also going to talk about what can go wrong during detox, what kind of symptoms can come up, how can you incorporate practices or give the person practices that you can incorporate to help them to have a really pleasant experience with detoxification. So disclaimer, yada, yada, yada. This is information, not medical advice. If you have a health condition, talk to your doctor before making any changes. What are signs that your client needs to detox? They can be anything and everything, in fact. And that's what I found out. That was the discovery that changed my life. But some of the common ones are headaches, skin rashes, just overall fatigue, sluggishness, or driving themselves on coffee and sugar, as I was. I didn't realize I was tired. Irritability, constipation, brain fog, inability to lose weight, and many more. But the key is, if people are really doing things fairly right, you know what I mean? They're not the person that's doing the junk food and they're really following a decent diet lifestyle, and they're still having issues, it's probably because they're toxic. And they even more so need to. When the weight doesn't come off, if I have somebody go through a week-long program of, you know, going gluten-free or whatever, and they don't drop weight, I know that there's something wrong. And a lot of times it's the body has this extra fat that it doesn't want to let go on of because a lot of toxins are stored in the fat. And we're going to go through the mechanisms of how that works. So these are just, I'm not going to read these all. On slide four, there are 84 toxins common in our environment. All of these put a strain on the body. These are breathed in, they're found in foods, they're found on the surfaces of things, they're found in laundry sheets and detergents and you name it, air fresheners, everything and anything. These are things that are hurting. These are things that are putting a load, an extra toxic load on our bodies on a regular basis. If we were to look back through our ancestry a couple of hundred years ago or a couple of thousand years ago, it's unlikely that these chemicals would have found their way into their daily regime, into their daily intake in their bodies. Some of them may have, but most would not. And it's this inundation that we have with toxins in the environment. There's so many of them that it makes it really, really hard to be healthy unless you're making heroic efforts. So I want to talk to you, I loved this picture because it really sums it up a lot. The process of detoxification and elimination, that's what we're going to be talking about today. How do toxins get in? What kind of havoc do they wreak on your body when they're there? How do you safely remove them to restore the person back to health? So the toxins enter through breathing, the lungs, skin, or your gut. Those are the main routes of entry. If you can think of any others, let me know. The main organ of detoxification is the liver, but quite frankly, every cell in your body has the ability to detoxify. And your digestive tract is second to the liver in its ability to have some of these mechanisms that we're going to be talking about, these conjugation mechanisms and something related to cytochrome P450. that you are going to find in the gut as well. But the liver is by far and away the most potent source. The liver has these processes to go through. I'm going to share everything about those processes. And when it gets backed up, the toxins that it can't deal with get stored away. And they mostly get stored in places that contain fat. The liver itself can store toxins. The fat cells can store toxins. The brain, the myelin sheath. But really, any place in your body can store the toxins. And when these toxins get stored away and they're not adequately detoxified, they put a strain on those organs. And you can see all sorts of signs, some of them we mentioned before, like the rashes and allergies and gut stuff and constipation, headaches, and way more. A lot of people are misdiagnosed as having some sort of weird, bizarre illness, when indeed all they are is toxic. And I don't mean to make light of it either. Being toxic is serious, and there are things that we can do about it. So toxins exit through your skin. So when you mobilize toxins in your body and your liver processes them, you can sweat them out through your skin. You can pee them out via your kidneys. You can poop them out via your colon, and you can exhale them out via your lungs. Those are the main organs of elimination. Okay? So let's get into some of the details. I want you to walk away from this presentation feeling like you own detoxification. You may not remember every chemical that I talked to you about, and glucuronidation and glycination and all this sort of stuff, but you'll know the overall scheme of it. And more so, you'll be really comfortable guiding somebody through a detoxification process. So where did the toxins come from? Our world, our home, our food, and our body. Your body generates just as many toxins as you get from the outside. And by design, we're set up to deal with toxins. We're not designed to set up with the myriad of toxins we get all over the place. So look at that air. Look at all those cleaning products and body care products. We're inundated with toxins. Whereas in years gone by, we just basically had to deal with our own generated toxins. So we're going to go through all of these. We're going to look at the external toxins, and I like to call them exotoxins, and internal toxins, which I refer to as endotoxins. And there may be some specific medical terminology around those words, but I'll give you the definitions, and you can call them what you'd like to. External toxins, they come from all over the place. We all know about the environmental pollutions, but dental amalgams, too, are a really serious source of toxins that enter our body from the outside. And so many people have had mercury fillings put into their mouths when they were little and still have them. I was really surprised as I went through and started asking people after I had a wake-up call about dental amalgams. It's like, how many do you have? Do you have them? And people who I know are very aware and very health conscious that they still have mercury in their mouths. Things like old paints. They chip off, you touch them, they leach, especially paints that used to contain lead if you live in an old building. Blinds and canned goods, these are just things you touch all the time. There's aluminum in your antiperspirant if you use it, and I highly recommend that you recommend that your clients don't. For a couple of reasons. One, antiperspirant contains aluminum, which is toxic. But on the other hand, you don't want to stop your perspiration. Perspiration is a way of exiting for the toxins. So if your body's detoxifying and you're not allowing it to sweat, guess what? Those toxins are going to recycle, recirculate, go back, affect your brain, affect your skin, other places. Your underarms are meant to have to be sweating. Okay? And then antacids. Hopefully you know better than using antacids. We had a wonderful presentation for the digestive tract, and you have all kinds of alternatives for heartburn and reflux. Mold, it's all around. I mean, you go into places that are not cleaned up, you walk into somebody's car sometimes, and it smells moldy. So mold is all around us. Anytime there's humidity, there's mold. Occupational exposure, so people who work in mines or pottery, some of those paints, you have to be really careful. Mechanics, farm workers, are exposed to things. the air quality and sick building quality. People think about the external toxins, the stuff outside, but the inside air is probably more toxic than the outside air. For one thing, I know most people I know leave their windows closed year-round. In the summer, it's too hot, so they have the air conditioner on. In the winter, it's too cold, so they have the heater on. And in the summer and spring, sometimes it's too wet, or in some places, it's either hot or cold. I keep my windows open all the time, and I would recommend that you do too, and you recommend people that at least for 10 or 20 minutes a day, they open the window. Even in the hot of summer, I live in Austin, Texas, where it's up to be 98 to 110 in the summer. We keep the windows in our bedroom open all day. We keep that door shut because we're fortunate enough to have it on a separate cycle. And then we turn the air conditioning on before we go to bed for an hour if it's hot. If it's not, we leave it off. And then we actually shut the air conditioning down and sleep in the heat. Well, not heat, it's comfortable. But we sleep in the summer without air conditioning. I would say 90 to 95% of nights in the summer. So I'm not saying you have to do that. We're very fortunate. We have a separate zone on the bedroom, so we can do that. But I would at least recommend that in the early morning, middle of the night, whatever, you open up your windows. I even open them in the winter when it's cold out. And yes, we do get cold sometimes here. Not very, but I don't think I would open them if it was 10 below. But I certainly open them when it's 25 or 30 degrees, which it gets to occasionally. And I leave them open, at least just a crack, to get some air in. You need to be getting rid of the old air and bringing in new air. The outside air is better, unless you're living in, like, there's a fire going on and it's full of air. So smoke, you know, people that are breathing in or smoking and breathing in other people's smoke. Various chemicals, there's so much in the personal care. I would highly recommend that you make a point of starting to read everything and then talk to your people about that. When they're complaining about various and sundry conditions, you're going to pick your poison, so to speak. You're going to pick where you're going to start with that. But it's really, really important, and maybe even just have them bring in their bottles and you can look at them or make copies. Or what my people do is they send me the names or the links to the products and I can look at them and tell them nay or yay. But I really like to empower people to make that decision without me having to tell them yay or nay, just because I've trained them enough to be able to do that. Plastics, soft plastics, plastics that you put food into, they contain a lot of hormone inhibitors, phthalates, UV radiation, and the things that we take in, trans fats, high fructose corn syrup, processed foods, refined flours. These are all coming from outside, and they're putting a strain. Our liver has to deal with them, detoxify them, neutralize them, and excrete them. And we're going to be really familiar. I'm going to leave you. We have a lot of slides with the toxins from the world. I talk about them. I don't need to go over those with you here, slides 8 through 12. I recommend that you read them on your own. It's just really, it's probably beating a dead horse. You probably know about a lot of these things, and you can read them and help people to stay away from these things, okay? Stay away from these things, because it's a constant stress. It's a constant thing that's happening day in and day out. It's not like every now and then you go to a restaurant and you drink tap water and you get toxins. No, this is stuff you're doing day in and day out. Read the labels. The thing I would have you do is make sure you read the labels with people that are gluten intolerant or dairy intolerant. A lot of times dairy and gluten are used in those products, in the hair care products and toothpastes and everything. Formaldehyde, radon, lead, carbon monoxide, arsenic, vinyl chloride, hydrofluoric acid. So I'm giving you a little bit of a description of what these are. So this is like a reference document for you. The VOCs, the solvents, the disinfection, pesticides. And you know, speaking of VOCs, volatile organic compounds, these are in paint, when we paint the house, right? So if you ever have gone away and then come back, your house is closed for several weeks, you come back in, you really notice the smell because you've been away from it. And I've noticed that too. And my house hasn't been painted in many years. But still, except for my office, which we did with no VOC paint. But these no VOC paints are now available routinely. They cost a little bit more, but heck, how often do you paint your house, really? And it's your health. So I would say, look at if you've got the if you're coming up with having to paint, look at the no VOC paints that they have at all the major chains. Now, it used to be you had to really search far and wide to get them. So those are toxins in our world. The toxins at home include the cleaning supplies, carpets, paint, air fresheners, even cooking utensils, like the non-stick coating on the Teflon pans or those flipper things. When you combine that with heat, you're going to get leaching of that stuff in, so you want to be careful. Supposedly, there's one or two brands that are decent that they don't. I think Dr. Mercola had talked about those, but otherwise, they're just not good for you. Just use good old stainless steel or wood as a utensil. Okay, deodorant, soaps, and deodorants, especially, you know, you're plugging up those sweat glands. I mean, that's a source of underarms is where there's a lot of lymphatic. And when the lymph is there, you know, you don't want to plug it up because it's going to plug up your immune system. Even these days, makeup and body care products, there's so many nice lines now that are not putting chemicals in them. It's a little bit more expensive, but toxins from the food. There's 3 pages of toxins in your food. And I want to point out a few of these to you. Mercury, obviously, you guys know about mercury and lead, really toxic to the nervous system, very, very toxic to the nervous system and the immune system. It's important. Yes, that there can be gluten and dairy in the shampoos and body products. You should read it. A lot of times gluten protein or milk protein is used to make your hair shinier. So you got to be careful with that, because not only are people, you're in the shower, you've got it in your hands, you're putting it on your head, it gets absorbed through your skin, so if you're very sensitive to it, it could be a problem. So when we get to toxins from the food, right, we've got mercury and lead, which are neurotoxins, and then there's the pesticides. So if you're buying organic, okay, you can avoid most of the pesticides. You have a hard time avoiding those GMOs because those seeds keep flying from one farm to the next, but definitely can avoid the pesticides. Sugar is something that you can easily avoid, and sugar is definitely a toxin. It's a neurotoxin as well, I believe, and it triggers lots of problems. It triggers changes in neurotransmitters and your immune system, etc. Food additives, acrylamides. What are acrylamides? Acrylamides are produced when you heat starches in the oven. So it has to be above a certain temperature. It doesn't happen when you steam them with water, but when you dry heat starches like potatoes or corn in an oven, it creates a chemical called acrylamides, and they have been associated with cancer. So it's a toxin that gets in your system. The sodium nitrate in processed meats, it's another source of toxicity in your food, affects your body dramatically. It creates free radical formation, and it's something for the liver to have to work on. And then polychlorinated biphenyl, dioxin, farmed fish, meat, and dairy. So these are things that we shouldn't be putting in our bodies. I don't think anybody's studied the long-term effects of these, and the short-term effects are not pretty. We've already identified a lot of these things as neurotoxins, yet we're still allowed to put them on the food. So your choice is educating your clients to avoid these things. Bisphenol A is a hormone antagonist, a hormone disruptor. It's in canned foods, in plastic. Dioxins, recombinant bovine growth hormone. Oh, that's another one. They give these animals not just real growth hormone, but it's genetically modified bovine growth hormone, and it's being put in dairy. The long-term effects of that are scary to me. And aspartame, it's already been identified as a neurotoxin. People who have MS and go off of the aspartame and get it better, there's a lot of online research about that. But aspartame, diet sodas, and artificially sweetened foods, they've got to go. You've got to talk to them about it. Arsenic. When you eat chickens that are not grown organically, they tend to have high levels of arsenic. Hydrogenated oils, they're found all over the place, shockingly all over the place. And it's just, you just have to really be careful. I think somebody was eating Mary's crackers the other day. They don't have that in there. But most of the crackers that you buy at the store are loaded with hydrogenated oils. Why? Shelf life. Artificial colors, artificial flavors, neurotoxins, they affect detoxification. Teflon and other coated cookware give off noxious gases when they're heated. And finally, monosodium glutamate, which is found hidden in a lot of foods that say natural foods on them, or natural flavorings, in a really disguised MSG. So these are the things you're teaching people to avoid. The first part of detox is always reducing the toxic load. And so many people want to jump right into some fancy detox product. And which is the best detox product on the market, they say, over their cup of coffee or their beer and pizza. Which detox product should I try? Well, start by decreasing the toxic load. And then we'll talk about how to get in there and really upregulate those cycles. Endotoxins. Let's talk about endotoxins. I think traditionally in human physiology and anatomy, they'll talk a lot about endotoxins being more bacterial endotoxins. Toxins that are produced from the gut bugs and the bugs that are living in your body that you haven't really invited but have taken hold. But really, I look at endotoxins as anything that's generated inside your body. Every single thought you think, muscle you move, food, piece of food you digest, thought you think, everything generates toxins. Anger and stress generate more toxins than most. Moving your muscles, the whole process of creating ATP creates oxidative stress on the body. So we need to be able to get rid of this. We need our detoxification pathways to be open so that we can get rid of the toxins that our own body produces in addition to all the stuff from outside. It's like, well, didn't we have enough to deal with on our own? Do we have to add insult to injury and add all those things from the environment? So there's a lot here, a lot of things. And the microbial toxins from any kind of organism, it's not just a candida thing. Yeasts, bacteria, viruses, parasites, all produce bacterial endotoxins. I have a really cool picture to show you in just a bit. Actually, right here. So I look at the endotoxins as any toxins that are produced inside your body, either from normal bodily functions or produced by microbes living in your body, such as bacteria, fungus, yeasts, or parasites. So if you look at this cell, you can see that there's a layer in the, they call it the LPS, meaning lipopolysaccharide layer, between the center of the cell, the cytoplasm of the cell, and the cell membrane. There's a layer there. That's where the endotoxins lie. So it explains to you why when you go on a detox program, or specifically like an anti-candida or an anti-parasitic program, and you're taking some supplements to kill off these bacteria and these bugs, they're releasing those toxins into your bloodstream. And that's why some people feel worse when they start to detox, is because they're getting rid of these bugs. And the bugs are, you just can't keep up with the toxins that they're producing. For a lot of people, that's why it's really important to move slowly through any process of detox or colon cleanse. So you can see that. And when that gets released, this other picture is even cooler. So you've got the nucleus of the macrophage. That first cell is that little cute macrophage. You see it looks kind of like a hungry little dinosaur head with the bacteria going into its mouth. You see that? It ingests the gram-negative bacteria. And then the bacteria is broken down inside the macrophage. It's degraded. And it releases the endotoxins. And those endotoxins induce that macrophage to produce some interleukin-1, IL-1. And it's released into the bloodstream, travels to the hypothalamus and the brain. And when it gets there, it induces the hypothalamus to produce prostaglandins to reset the body's thermostat to a higher temperature, so to produce heat. So this is what happens when you're exposed to a bacteria and how you get a fever, how that proceeds. So it's those toxins from the bacteria, when you actually do start to try to kill it, that induce the fever. And the fever, the higher temperature, is helping you to get rid of it more quickly. So we've got toxins made inside your body. Where are they made? So let's look. Well, every time you exercise, you have toxins that build up. So lactic acid is one of them. But your body has to deal with that. Your liver has to recover from that. You've got stress. Cortisol produces lots of toxins in its wake. You've got exposures, the environment, like we talked about, environment, food. You've got the foods, whether the foods are fully supporting you or they're missing nutrients or they've got toxicity in them. They're going to play a role in your toxic load. Detox mechanisms. When actually while you're detoxing the environment, you're producing you're reducing byproducts. So detox has its own metabolic byproducts and toxic byproducts. Your immune system certainly does. We saw that before. You have all those agents, those things that break down, they degrade, the enzymes that break down and degrade the various toxins and the bacteria and things that get into your system. So your immune system, definitely. Well, we know our digestive produces metabolic toxins, and sometimes it erupts in terms of painful and not so nice smelling gas. Those are toxins, putrefactive products of the breakdown of food. When you don't have the right enzymes, or when you're doing it in a hurry, or you're under stress when you're trying to eat. So that brings us full circle right back to exercise. So all of these things, some of which are really good for us, like eating good foods and exercising and detoxing and producing muscular movement, these are all going to be causing problems if you don't have the right mechanisms in place to get rid of them. So it looks like a bedroom slipper with some nice massage units to massage your feet. Hey, stick your foot in there and walk around and you're going to get a good massage on your foot. But actually, what is it? It's a mitochondria. It's the inside of a mitochondria. And a mitochondria are the powerhouses of every cell. They live in every cell. And while they produce energy for you, they also lead to oxidative stress. A lot of stress on the system, a lot of chemical byproducts of mitochondrial work. The other places they're produced, the adrenal glands, the muscles, the digestive tract, the brain, the lungs, and the liver. Microbial endotoxins come from the overgrowth of yeasts, which are mycotoxins are produced by them. Bacteria produce endotoxins and exotoxins. Viruses produce oxidants, the damaged cells that the virus is in terms of getting rid of them, or the virus is attaching to the cells. And then parasites, they're oxidants produced by parasites as well as by cells and tissues to try to fight them. So what causes microbial overgrowth? What causes these overgrowths that create the toxicity in your gut? Well, sugar for sure, that feeds yeast and funguses big time. It disables your macrophages, so it causes more bacteria to be able to take hold. If you've had antibiotics, and you've had too many antibiotics, it messes up your gut flora. Even one round of antibiotics is antibiotic abuse in some cases, because it disrupts your normal flora. And then, of course, pesticides and pollutants are big time causes of overgrowth. So these are the kinds of health challenges that you'll be looking for when your client presents to you. They're going to want to get over these challenges. They may not know there's anything to do with toxicity related to their symptoms. They may not think there's anything to do with their food or their exercise or their thoughts. So it's your job to educate them differently. So things like fibromyalgia, chronic fatigue syndrome, chemical sensitivity syndrome, attention and focusing problems, those are all very almost vague and nebulous concepts, yet they're very real if you're experiencing them. If you go to a doctor, a standard traditionally trained medical doctor, and you talk about fibromyalgia, it's a bucket description. It's something that you put you in because you can't find anything else to describe. Same thing with chronic fatigue, and chemical sensitivity isn't even recognized by most of those practitioners. But the truth is that toxic overload can affect your attention, your focus, your mood, cause you to be depressed, anxious, irritable, can cause you to have headaches, it can cause you to have irritable bowel, joint pain, and allergies. So lots of things can result from toxic overload, and you probably already know this, but I want you to be aware these are the kinds of things, this is what you're looking for when you see somebody presenting this way. So I said that the liver was the main source of detoxification, and I mentioned the digestive tract. I mentioned that the skin is an elimination route because you can sweat through it, and toxins can leave through the sweat. The kidney is a good source of detox because once the liver's gone through the detoxification pathways, made the toxins water soluble, you can pee them out through your kidneys. Of course, sweat and your lungs, breathing them out. So, but by far the most detox activity happens in the liver. Now, this picture gives us an overview. It calls it step one and step two. We usually call it phase one and phase two. And your toxins have to go through both phase one and phase two before they can be eliminated. Some of them are eliminated via the bile duct. They go out the bile duct and go down through the gallbladder into the bile and go out through your bowel. Others are eliminated via the kidneys. They're filtered in the blood. The liver's done it best it can, puts them in the blood, the filter filters it more, and comes out as urine. Okay? So there's a list on here of different amino acids and vitamins and minerals that are required for step one and step two, or as I like to call them, or as is traditionally called in functional medicine, phase one and phase two. And some of those nutrients for phase one are the B vitamins, folic acid, glutathione, generally antioxidants like milk thistle, SOD, those are good ones too, carotenoids, vitamin A derivatives, vitamin E and C. So your standard antioxidants, which are ACE, ACE, and then in addition some others. Milk thistle is very specific for the liver. It's an antioxidant for the liver. So the nutrients to go through stage two are a whole bunch of amino acids, and I'm going to highlight that and show you for each of those stages what those are. Glutamine, glycine, taurine, and cysteine, especially. Sulfur-related phytochemicals. Garlic and cruciferous vegetables. So sulfur-containing stuff in garlic and cruciferous vegetables in general. So that's your body's cleanup crew. Let's go deeper. So liver detoxification, we know that it neutralizes the fats. It takes them and converts fat-soluble toxins to water-soluble substances that can be excreted. The direct route of blood from the intestine to the liver is amazing. It makes the liver and the gut be able to talk to each other. What it does is when you have some toxins that have come in, like say the toxins have come in through your gut, and you pull out all the nutrients and the bolus of food ends up in your large intestine ready for excretion. And throughout that, there's water being reabsorbed from the colon. And that vessel goes straight to the liver. And the reason that that's a good thing is that it prevents the toxins from going and making a whole tour around your body before it gets to the liver. See, if there wasn't that direct connection between the liver and the intestine, then those toxins would have the ability to have a ride around the body, around the bloodstream, and can cause havoc in your system. So we've kept it smart and have that direct link via the vessel that goes from the liver to the digestive tract. Or the digestive tract to the liver, I should say. So the liver detoxification neutralizes the toxins, converts fat soluble to water soluble, and it has a phase one and phase two. So if you look here, this is an example of how NSAIDs, non-steroidal anti-inflammatories, are handled and processed through the liver. So if you look, there's a spot where NSAID can be sulfated and excreted as an inactivated, basically. It can also go through the phase one, phase two, and there's a hydroxy group that's added to the NSAID to make it more excretable before it goes to the kidney. And then the other part is directly with the glucuronate. So I'll talk to you more about those pathways in a minute. You'll understand what those are. But keep cytochrome P450. You're going to see that a lot. Cytochrome P450 refers to those enzymes that are involved in the liver detoxification pathway. This is a great chart to have. I'm really excited that I found this chart because it's really good. All right, so look at the top. It shows you where the toxins are coming from, either endotoxins or exotoxins from outside. The toxins enter the liver and they go through phase one and phase two. So here it puts it out as phase one. Phase one reactions are pretty straightforward. There's not a whole lot of nutrition. There are some nutrients that are needed and used during that process, but it's not as nutrient heavy as required for phase two. So you've got reactions that happen like oxidation, reduction, hydrolysis, hydration, and dehalogenation. That's what happens to those toxins. And then they go and they become intermediates. So think of it as two rooms. And it was a really great description I saw somewhere. I'll use that description. You go to the airport and you go with this newfangled checkout thing. You just stick your credit card in and it checks you in, and now you have your ticket. It used to be you had to wait in a long line there, and then you had to wait in a line to get through the gate. Well, now that phase one, think of the getting your ticket is phase one. It's really quick. It's really easy. Nothing to it. Then you have to go through phase two, and you have to stand in this long line, and then you have to take half your clothes off and take your computer out of the bag and take all your shampoo out. And by the time you're standing there, you know, half naked with all your belongings in these little pouches sitting, going through baskets, and it takes a long time. It's not just like go up to the machine, stick your credit card in, out pops your ticket, and you go. So phase one is kind of like those nice automatic ticket booths for checking you in at the airport. Quick, easy, boom, done. But now you have to go wait on the line. And the more people are coming in, and as fast as that process is to begin with for getting your ticket, that other process isn't going to get any faster. And so the line gets longer and longer and longer and longer. And all you are waiting, you're waiting in limbo. Meanwhile, you're like carrying your bag. You want to sit down. It's that intermediate, okay? That's what happens with the liver. Goes through phase one, gets its ticket real quick, and then it sits there and waits. The problem, though, is you don't necessarily become toxic after you get your ticket. The toxins that you're detoxifying, actually, some of them actually become more toxic when they get processed through phase one, because the intent is that there's never a delay. That phase one happens, and then phase two happens, and then we're done. That as soon as you leave phase one, you go into phase two. But that's not what's happening for a lot of people. A lot of people are what are called paradoxical or pathological detoxifiers, meaning phase one is just humming along, and phase two is slow as molasses. So you have these toxic intermediates. Now your liver's all tied up trying to handle the people that are already in, the toxins that are already in phase two. So what happens is this, basically those toxins get a ride around the block. They get to ride through your body. And some people experience that as headaches or sluggishness or foggy brain, breaking out in a skin rash. And it's all because they have sped up the detoxification on one end, and they're releasing toxins from their body stores. And then all of a sudden they're in a slowdown. So those intermediate processes need to be eliminated. They need to be eliminated. So some of the nutrients, they're all listed on the chart. I'll go through them in more detail on a separate chart. But there's processes called sulfation, glucuronidation, glutathione conjugation, amino acid conjugation, acetylation, and methylation. So there's six pathways. Okay? And when those are humming along, like I said, when you have all the specific nutrients for each of those pathways, which we'll review, detox goes along nicely. And you end up putting out the end result toxins in the bile, which are eliminated as feces, or in the kidney, the serum that goes to the kidneys and goes out in the urine. So let's go into a little bit more detail about the phases of liver detox. Like I said, there's a blood vessel straight from your digestive tract to your liver. So 98% of the toxins are neutralized by the liver before they get into circulation in a healthy person. There's a little bit that sneaks by, right? But most of the toxins that go from the blood vessel in your digestive tract into the liver will do so very effectively, and only 2% of them are ever going to make it into circulation. But if you're not healthy, if you have that paradoxical or pathological response, as I just described, where phase one is faster than phase two, those toxins are going to get a chance to go around. And sometimes even 100% may be able to go around. And that's not good for you. Okay? Phase one, think of it as a simple process. They all get the same one or two different reactions. Everything goes through. All the toxins. There's no differentiation between the types of toxins. However, in phase two, we're personalizing it. Okay? We're saying, oh, what does this toxin need to be eliminated? What does this? And there's specific categories, which I'll share with you, that go through the different phases of phase two. So there's six parts to phase two. And there's some conjugation, combining these with amino acids, with vitamins, with minerals, and with antioxidants to form new compounds that are then safe to circulate in your system and get eliminated by the kidneys. Here's part of the problem. There are certain things that actually speed up phase one, that make it go even faster. And they're not nutrients, they're problems. So if you drink alcohol, caffeine, you take aspirin or Tylenol, you smoke, or you take other drugs like phenobarbital, steroids, and sulfa drugs, those are going to give a message to the liver that says, whoa, we got a big toxic load, causes phase one to speed up. It's easy to speed up phase one. So that makes the pathological detoxification even worse. So let's look at some of the things that speed up phase one and slow down phase one. Typically you would think, oh, I don't want to do anything to slow down my detoxification. I just want to do things to speed it up. Well, in the case of phase one with a pathological detoxifier, you definitely want to do some things to slow it down. So the things that will speed it up are some of the same things that also speed up phase two, so we don't want to avoid them. Of course, we do want to avoid those toxins I mentioned on the previous page. Alcohol, caffeine, nicotine, some of the drugs, acetaminophen and barbiturates. But you don't want to really say, oh, I'm going to deprive my body of vitamin C and that way it will slow down phase one. No, you don't want to do that. You want to keep those levels because those levels are going to be helpful for other processes. What you want to do is slow down phase one and speed up phase two at the same time. So there's a chemical called naringenin in grapefruit. And that is very good at slowing down phase one. Turmeric. In fact, it can be dangerous to be doing grapefruit or grapefruit juice when you're on the medications that need to be detoxified, because they don't, when you speed up phase one but you don't speed up phase two, it actually helps those drugs go around for a second time, or a component of them, and it can be dangerous. So the other things that slow down are turmeric. Turmeric, wonderful herb, anti-inflammatory, antioxidant, really super for the liver. Capsaicin, that's another thing that's found in chili peppers, clove, and quercetin and calendula. Those are things that slow down phase one and also speed up phase two, most of them. The grapefruit juice doesn't, but the others do. That's your ideal, is to slow down the phase one and speed up the phase two if you have a pathological detoxifier. So there is a picture. There's the liver lobe, and you've got all these bile little canaliculi in there, and they bring the bile to and from, they bring the toxins to and from, and the toxins are then put back out into the portal circulation. So if you look here at the vessels, right, you've got your gallbladder over on the left-hand side, and it's that little green ball, and there's a green vessel, that's your bile, that's not blood turned green, it's actually your bile, and then the blue is the portal vein, and the red is the artery that's bringing fresh blood from the heart. So the portal vein actually brings blood from the vessels, from the intestines to the liver. You've got the right lobe, you've got the left lobe, and there's another lobe in the back. This is one of my favorite analogies. Okay, I was playing this video earlier and I was capturing the little picture, and my son's say, "What are you playing that? Why do you keep playing that?" Because I was trying to capture just the right scene in a screen share shot. And I said, "Well, because it relates to the presentation that I'm finishing up for today." He goes, "What? What does that have to do with your presentation?" So I explained it to him, just like I'm going to explain to you. The phase one to phase two, the buildup of toxic intermediates are stored as fat, they're stored in the brain, and they're stored in the myelin, and they create symptoms like headaches, sluggishness, brain fog, and focus problems. So phase two can keep up with phase one as long as things aren't coming too fast and furious. So this is a video, it's on YouTube, I gave you the link, of Ethel and Lucy. They are at the chocolate factory where they've been given the job of putting the little chocolates in their little papers and sending them further down on the line. And they were told, don't let anything pass you. If anything passes you, you're going to get fired. So they're going along and everything's just beautiful, just like the liver's going, oh, great, get rid of it, get rid of it, putting them downstream. And then it started to speed up a little, and you saw them having to step up the pace. And then it got so fast that things were starting to slide by them, so they started taking some of the chocolates off and shoving them in their pockets and in their mouth and in their hats. That's what your liver does when it can't keep up. It shoves those toxins away because it doesn't want them to escape into circulation. It starts shoving as many of them as it can into storage. And the way that it stores it is in fat mostly. Your brain and myelin are fat, which means that it's going to affect your brain and the transmission and movement to your extremities. And your myelin sheaths can get damaged, a process called multiple sclerosis, where there's autoimmune damage to your myelin sheaths, which means that the signal from your brain to your leg takes a long time to get there. And these people have difficulty walking and eventually end up in wheelchairs. So they create headaches when you have a buildup of these toxins, because inevitably the liver can't keep up, and it can't keep up with storing this fat, because just like Ethel and Lucy found, a couple of those slid by. Okay, so watch that video. It's kind of fun to watch. So understanding phase two detoxification. So phase one is easy. It requires a few nutrients. It's a hydrolysis kind of reaction, produces these toxic intermediates. The toxic intermediates then go through one of the six pathways. There's really six. If you look down at the bottom, glycination is really a subset of amino acid conjugation. Glycine is an amino acid, so I'll explain to that when I get there. So there's really six main pathways. And depending on what type of toxin, whether it's mercury, heavy metals, whether it's endotoxins from your gut bacteria, whether it's a particular pesticide or herbicide or paint or any of those things, they have different constituents and structures, including your own body stuff like your hormones and your neurotransmitters. So depending, they will go through any one of these phases. The glutathione conjugation, where the toxin is, you know, kind of paired up with glutathione to try to detoxify it. Amino acid conjugation, where it's tied up with any of a number of amino acids for release. Methylation, where methyl groups are added there, and those are specific chemical groups that that helps to move processes in the body more effectively, improves detoxification. Sulfation, where sulfur is added. Acetylation, where acetyl-CoA is added. And then glucuronidation, where glucuronic acid is added. But there's more than just the amino acids or the methyls, etc., required for it to go through. There are a number of nutrients that are important. And like I said, glycination is really a subset of amino acid conjugation, so we'll look at that as part of that. Some of the nutrients required for glutathione conjugation would be precursors to glutathione. So either glutathione itself or precursors like cysteine, glycine, glutamic acid, and various cofactors. Essential fatty acids, including omega-6 and omega-3, like black currant, flaxseed, EPA. Parathyroid tissue sometimes. Sometimes that's helpful. Amino acid conjugation requires glycine and also other ones that we'll look at when we do a separate page on that. Methylation, it's methyl donors. So methyl B12, methyl folate, magnesium, methionine. And then sulfation would be anything that has sulfur groups. So cysteine, its precursor methionine, also taurine. They are amino acids that contain sulfur. And then things like B12, folic acid, methyl donors, magnesium, B6 and B5, B6, SVP, P5P, and then MSM. They all are important forms for providing sulfur to this phase two part. Acetylation, it requires acetyl-CoA, and those are just a short list. You also need vitamin B5 and a couple of others, so I'll go through those on the individual pages. Glucuronidation, pretty straightforward. You add glucuronic acid, you add magnesium. Glycination, it uses arginase, glycine, and cofactors like folic acid, manganese, B2, B6, B5. So we'll get more into each of those, but this is just a general list so you can have it all in one place of some of the nutrients needed for detox. And there's a list, foods that detox and foods that hurt detox, foods that help detox, foods that hurt detox. So these are some of the nutrients, amino acids, vitamin C, glutathione, sulfur-containing substances like MSM, B1, B2, B3, B6, B12. That about covers most of the Bs, and plus folic acid, and then the EFAs, blackcurrant, seed oil, flax oil, EPA. Then there's some minerals like manganese, molybdenum, magnesium, iron, selenium, and zinc. So all of these are feeding these pathways to help you so that you don't end up with a person with a sluggish phase two and a fast phase one. These are going to help support the whole process. So let's go through each of these pathways in the liver in a little bit more detail. Again, if you remember these, great. I think it's going to be useful, but keep the charts handy to refer back to. These are nice little summary charts. The methylation pathway will help you get rid of dopamine, histamine, heavy metals, and estrogen. So these are important things to be getting out. And the way that you help that process along is choline, important, and that you can find in avocado, soy, and sunflower, and lecithin in particular. B vitamins, beets for the betaine. Betaine in beets helps with the methylation. SAMe, which is acetyl methionine. And 500 milligrams three times a day seems to be really helpful for detox, especially for pushing the methylation pathways, and especially if you have a genetic disorder that affects the methylation pathways, which is very common, and we'll be talking about that shortly. And then we have regular methionine, magnesium. With folate, you want to make sure it is methylfolate, because methylfolate is the real deal. Folic acid is not, and it'll actually thwart the methylation pathway, whereas methylfolate will feed it. And of course, the methyl B12 and the donors. And it seems like it works best in terms of your, if you have one of these genetic issues with methylation, that it's best to take your methyl B12 and then follow it up within a half hour or so with the methylfolate to give them some space. And then for methyl donors, anything that could donate an extra methyl group, like trimethylglycine. How many methyls do you think that has? One, two, three. Trimethylglycine or dimethylglycine, right? So one has three and one has two. Tri has three, di has two. And then MSM, really good source of methyl groups. Yeah, B5 should be added to that for sure. And you'll see why. It's in one of the pathways here. The acetylation one, for sure, we need B5. Because just like for steroid hormones, you need B5 for doing a conversion that involves acetyl-CoA. So that's methylation. Sulfation helps us get rid of phenols, bile acids, used-up thyroid hormone, acetaminophen, aspartame, bacterial endotoxins, neurotransmitters, xenoestrogens, and then basically used-up steroid hormones, cortisol, androgen, and female. This is really important. It's really important that we not be inhibiting this. And we can inhibit it with NSAIDs, non-steroidal anti-inflammatories. Also, though, taking too much molybdenum, which is kind of hard to do, but vitamin B6 over about 100 milligrams a day. And some people do take more than that of vitamin B6. So be aware of how much B6 they're taking and what form to see if it might be an issue that causes them to have lower sulfation. And then how do you support sulfation? Well, the amino acids, methionine, cysteine, and taurine, because they're sulfur-containing. Any high sulfur foods like brassicas and MSM. Glutathione itself, although it's not really highly absorbable orally, but you can take it as a patch or a skin cream. And then NAC, which is N-acetylcysteine, which is a precursor. It's got all the building blocks you need to make glutathione. Glucuronidation helps you get rid of bilirubin and bile acids. Well, yeah, you know, that's a metabolic waste, right? That's something that's generated in our own bodies, and it needs to be gotten rid of. Salicylates, aspirins, and over-the-counters, common over-the-counter medications, are often glucuronized. Morphine, air pollutants, fatty acid derivatives, so some of those oxidized fats, retinoids, which are members of the vitamin A. They're similar to vitamin A, but there's synthetic ones made for acne treatment. Aspirin, food additives, preservatives. These are all detoxified in this glucuronidation pathway, as well as aspartame. So you see that some of these items came up twice. So some of them have to go through a couple of different pathways to get fully detoxified. The things that inhibit are aspirin and fluoride. So you need to be asking people about their headache history and how often they take aspirin. But more importantly, and more common, a source of inhibition is fluoride, because it's put in the water. So how much tap water are they drinking? Do they have an adequate filtration system? And then how do you support glucuronidation? Omega-3s, really good, DHA and EPA. Also, limonene, which is the essential oil found in citrus. It's in the peel of the lemon, the lime, the orange, the grapefruit, tangerine. And then SAMe. And you can see SAMe shows up a lot in the various pathways. Glutathione is this master antioxidant. We have to really give it credit for being as important as it is. It is super, 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 super important. It's also very hard to come by. It's hard to absorb, and it's hard to get the levels up. One of the reasons it's hard to get the levels up is that there's a particular genetic issue with the glutathione transferase, GST, that inhibits the amount of glutathione that you make. And when that happens, then you don't conjugate with glutathione as well as you should, and liver detox is very slow and sluggish. It's a really important one because it does the heavy metals. So if you're going and getting your mercury removed, or somebody's exposed to heavy metals in the workplace, you want to make sure that their glutathione conjugation is working adequately. Okay, so it's an important part of a heavy metals program that you're supplementing with or doing something to improve their glutathione. One way that you can get glutathione in is IV. Not pleasant, not cheap, but it certainly can work. And I know people who are getting a lot of dental work done, and they're doing that afterwards. And some dentists, progressive dentists, are doing that, along with things like ozone and vitamin C therapy as well. Solvents. A lot of us are exposed to solvents. If you paint your fingernails and then you take them off, the acetone? Acetone is a solvent. If you use paints, if you paint and use oil paints, the solvents were used to clean your brushes. That's why I use watercolors. Herbicides and fungicides are processed through this pathway. Polycyclic aromatic hydrocarbons, which are a lot of the pollutants in the air, and then lipid peroxidases, or peroxides, which are basically byproducts of oxidized lipids, oxidized fats. So what do we do? Well, avoid glutathione, avoid aspirin and fluoride, and then supplement with the brassicas, the limonene, vitamin C, essential fatty acids, NAC, cysteine, glycine, glutamic acid, zinc and selenium, B vitamins, and alpha lipoic acid. So do you have to use all of them? No. Can you use a nice formula that has a bunch of them in it? Sure. Do you want to do individual ones? Yes, and then you sit down with the person and you make up, you know, what you think makes the most sense with them. And you make the most sense by based on which of these pathways are they contributing to more. Do they need to have their glutathione increased, or the methylation? That's a good question. So let's look on to the acetylation pathway, which gets rid of sulfa drugs, which is a kind of an antibiotic. Histamine, which is produced when you have an allergic reaction. Serotonin, which is produced all the time in your gut and your brain, keeps your mood good. PABA, pyrimenobenzoic acid. Procaine, which is topical analgesic. hydrazines, sulfur amides, and of course things like tobacco and other environmental toxins. So it's a matter of really working to improve all these pathways. But you can see as you learn more about what these pathways include, why the kinds of detoxification programs you might have been exposed to or been part of really do work, because you're really upregulating so many of the genes here. Then we have amino acid conjugation, which means basically shoving it together, shoving amino acid onto one of these intermediates so that they go down the right pathway. So xenobiotics, meaning anything kind of that resembles estrogen that's in the, well, in the environment, or various pollutants, salicylates, like in aspirin, but also it's preservative in certain things. And benzoate, preservative in lots of things. And toluene, which is a precursor to benzoate and can be converted into benzoate. So these are things you want to really be careful about. Okay, so inhibitors, because it's amino acid conjugation, you have to have enough protein. So the things that is not enough protein, either a low protein diet or poor stomach acid, can be a factor here that inhibits amino acid conjugation. So it's really looking and leaving no stone unturned. The nutrients that it needs are, of course, a bunch of amino acids like glycine, taurine, glutamine, arginine, ornithine. There's also some electrolytes, which is stuck in there just in case, potassium and alkaline. Eating an alkaline diet, potassium, sodium, and eating an alkaline diet, and then curcumin, which is from turmeric. This is a summary, again, of nutrients needed. It's not complete, and I think that I want to go back and make this complete, so it is a nice, complete summary. It goes through all of the processes. Substances that inhibit phase 2, glutathione conjugation, selenium deficiency, B2 deficiency, glutathione deficiency, zinc deficiency, amino acid conjugation, basically a low protein diet, methylation, folic acid and B12 deficiency, sulfation, non-steroidal anti-inflammatories, yellow food dye, molybdenum, acetylation, B2, B5, or C deficiency, and finally glucuronidation, aspirin, or I don't even how to say that, probenecid. So then there's some foods that support phase 2 detoxification, and I broke it down based on the pathways. You could just make yourself a master list, give the person a master list. I'm giving you the details so that you can make choices as to how do you want to present it. So again, we went through all these before. Brassicas for the glutathione. Brassicas are pretty much good for most of the pathways. That's your cabbage, broccoli, Brussels sprouts, etc. Limonene containing foods like citrus peel, dillweed oil, caraway oil, all of these help support phase 2. Glucuronidation, fish oils, limonene containing food. Methylation, beets, brassicas. Sulfation, brassicas. Amino acid conjugation, protein, and acetylation, garlic, onion, soy, berries, and grapes. These are all good foods to start getting people to eat. I mean, careful of the grapes if they have blood sugar problems. But certainly these are good foods to help people to get on to support their phase 2 detoxification. And here's another list. You can see I just pulled a lot of lists together. You make one big master list. So herbs that support the detox. Milk thistle is one of your best antioxidants for the liver. It doesn't actually promote any of the detox pathways per se, but it protects the liver from damage. Just dandelion, burdock, echinacea, artichoke leaf, and turmeric. And artichoke leaf, we're talking the big leaves on the plant. And these are all very helpful for supporting detoxification. So stamp out the foods that disrupt detox. And I know people say, well, how am I going to live my life? How am I going to be happy if I can't drink wine? And like, are you happy having to go to bed at 5 o'clock at night and not being able to get up again until 7 o'clock the next morning? I mean, come on. Really, how important is this? How important is your food compared to the rest of your life? So she, on this one, this list of foods that disrupt detox, it's not a complete list by any stretch of the imagination, but it's just something that you can have people write down and keep on their refrigerator, like, oh, don't do that, no, don't do that. Avoid exposure to toxins, right? That's the first step. You want to have people eating a high nutrient content diet, lots of sea vegetables, lots of green leafies, lots of good stuff. High nutrient content, high fiber diet, right? If you want to detox, you've got to have fiber. You've got to be moving your bowels. And one of the most common causes of constipation is stagnant liver. So you want to be getting those bowels moving, and keeping your diet high in fiber is going to keep the bowels moving so you can get the toxins out. Better out than in, right? Optimizing your digestion, of course, so you can extract as much nutrition from the food as you possibly can. And then exercise. It can be yoga, it can be running, it can be bicycling, whatever you choose. Of course, pure water, pure air, and reduce stress. You've heard that over and over again. Pure water, pure air, and reduce stress is a prescription for health. So some daily detox activities you can teach people to share and to do. You can share with them what to do is skin brushing, and that's where you do dry skin brushing. You brush yourself before you take a shower, and then you shower it off, and it increases the circulation. It's just really outstanding for the body. Tongue cleaning. I use one of those tongue scrapers twice a day. You scrape off whatever gunk is on your tongue. Keeps it nice and pink and clean, and the circulation to it is phenomenal. Saunas and steam baths. Those are good daily activities. You're not going to necessarily do those every day, but skin brushing and tongue cleaning, you certainly can. Saunas and steam baths would probably be relegated to the once or twice a week kind of range, although you can get the best results by doing them six times a week. So let's talk a little bit about using limonene for detox. Limonene, as I said earlier, is that essential oil of lemon or lime that's in the skin of the, and it's in the peel, and there it's extracted out, and it's a really good liver detox support. And then promoting the glutathione, potent antioxidant, limonene is really good for helping you to make more glutathione. Enhances both phase one and phase two, so it's not one that's going to push phase one at the expense of phase two. And it can float on the surface of the stomach lining to protect it from gastric juices. So I just really, really like the limonene, and I use a little bit of lemon oil in my water every morning, and I love the way it just wakes up my digestive tract. Let's see. Laura had a question. Is there sufficient iodine in sea vegetables to cause problems for those who have Hashimoto's? Well, if somebody has Hashimoto's and their iodine, they have too much iodine, they're on the brink, and taking in sea vegetables is going to put them over the edge, then yeah. But in general, most people are deficient in iodine. And I think that a lot of the studies that were done with the Hashimoto's and being aggravated by iodine were done in adding extra iodine to people who already had sufficient iodine, and they were done in Japan, if I'm not mistaken. So it's really an issue of, do you have enough or not? And anybody that has Hashimoto's, I would highly recommend get an iodine load test and then proceed very slowly. Dr. David Brownstein gives huge amounts of iodine to his Hashimoto's patients, and he gets them well. I know that Karazian is really across the board anti-iodine because of those studies, but I just believe that if you don't have enough iodine, your thyroid can't function. So it's a big controversy. When we did our talk on thyroid, we talked about the great iodine controversy, and there's enough people, really good researchers in both camps. I just believe it's an individual basis. So for most people, the amount of kelp, iodine and kelp is perfect, and it might aggravate somebody with Hashimoto's who is already iodine sufficient. Yes. I have a client who gave herself and her daughter Hashimoto's. I would love to chat with you about that, because I'd like to see how much excessive iodine she had. And yeah, if she was excessive, it certainly can cause that. It can cause a goiter if it's excessive. So yes, I just definitely tell people to proceed with caution with Hashimoto's and get your iodine checked before you just blatantly start adding a lot of sea vegetables. But you have to be doing a lot of iodine supplementation. You can do it. But I would, I'd like to see whether it was with iodine supplementation or with kelp, because you can do it with iodine supplementation. You can easily take in 50 milligrams a day with a few drops of SSKI or Lugol's. So it's not one of the common things. It's similar to the whole thing with the goitrogens and brassicas. Some people do have a problem with that, but for the most part, people, they're just not taking the quantity that they need to produce that kind of goitrogenic effect, similar with the Hashimoto's. And I think a few case studies got blown out of proportion. That's just been my experience with it. The reason I created the AM Gut Rejuvenator, I've actually put this together after I went to an herbalist conference, and they were talking about how to wake up the digestion, and it was peppermint oil and lemon oil first thing in the morning, and then both of them are really great for the liver for detoxification. So I love this drink, and everybody that I've put on it absolutely loves it. This is a starting point for you for a daily detox schedule. You're going to be adding things to it, taking things away, based on who you're working with and what they need. But overall, if you get them started with that 16 to 32 ounces of water every morning, instead of starting with the cup of coffee and the bagel, right? That's going to wake up their digestive tract. It's going to stimulate their detox. It's really an awesome way to start the day. And like I said, just about everybody that has tried this, there's been very few people who have said, in fact, I think I said one that said, I could take it or leave it. So, green breakfast. I love people to start the day with a green breakfast. And it could be a green smoothie, a green juice, a green soup. It could be steamed vegetables. It could be a green powder. But why not start the day with lots of nutrition? What other food is going to provide you with the level of nutrition as green? And I know a lot of you will do it during a detox, or you'll do it when you're doing Before Be Gone, and then you get out of that mode. But every day, that should become like their standard. And the chia seeds are just a great addition to it because of the staying power. They last for a long time. They help to bring down the blood sugars. They help to increase the sensitivity of the insulin receptors. They're filling and they're loaded with omega-3. So why not start the day with green and omega-3? If there's other stuff that they're going to add to it, so be it. But you start them with green and chia seed minimally and see where it goes. Most people that I've worked with have switched to, that's their breakfast. That's just the way they do it. Doing heart math before each meal so that you bring your cortisol levels down, so that you enhance the digestion. Right? A lot of the toxins that are getting produced are coming from the gut. It's coming from leaky gut. It's leaking in. It's coming from undigested, poorly digested putrefaction products in the gut. Most people don't digest. Chew, or blend the food, because you need to absorb the nutrients from the food. I like to get people on 4 cups of brassicas a day. There are going to be exceptions. There's people who don't tolerate them well. There's people who, for whatever reason, genetic or otherwise, don't handle all that sulfur or the methyl, or they do have some issues with their thyroid, and they're amongst the rare ones that can't handle 4 cups of brassicas. Quite frankly, when you look at the studies, they were done on rats, and the amount of brassicas that were given those rats isolated, it wasn't even brassicas, it was the isolated isothiocyanate from the equivalent of these huge volumes of brassicas that were more than what they weighed. And as humans, I don't know about you, but I don't think I could eat over 100 pounds a day of brassicas, but that's what the equivalent was in these little rats. So, and the studies they did with humans where they took them and fed them like the equivalent of 3 or 4 containers of broccoli sprouts every day, nothing happened. They measured them. So I think it's a little bit overrated, but of course everybody has to proceed with caution. If you're starting to see hypothyroid signs when you're doing a lot of brassicas, then you cut back. Okay. But the broccoli seeds, the broccoli sprouts are pretty incredible. And I interviewed Dr. Thomas Loda. He's an integrative oncologist on my radio show. And he said he finds that the seeds themselves, broccoli seeds, the most important nutrient you can give for improving phase 2 detoxification. He said it really gets in there. You just take the 2 seeds, you grind them up, you stick them in your smoothies, drink them down. I haven't gotten into the habit because I have to go out and buy more. But it certainly sounds easy enough. I've made a few little mixtures that were milk thistle ground up with the broccoli seeds with some seasonings. It was pretty darn yummy. And it works. So milk thistle seeds as well. You can grind them up. You can put them into things. I like to get things as much as food as possible rather than a lot of pills and a lot of potions. And greens at every meal and exercise. So if you're going to be putting somebody, this is for everyday detox. So if you're going to be putting somebody on a cleansing program, you're going to be doing more dramatic things. Okay. If you add this everyday routine to some skin brushing, even if they only do it a few days a week, some saunas, sweating, exercise, jumping on the rebounder, you're going to get them so that they're just detoxing consistently. So that when you do put them on a set detox program, if you do, then they'll be way ahead of the game and they won't be likely to experience a lot of the uncomfortable symptoms. We're going to talk to you about those uncomfortable things and how you can recognize when there's a problem and how to deal with some of the uncomfortable symptoms that people have. So what's the biggest mistake? The mistakes that people make when they're detoxing. I think for one, they go too fast. Sometimes people just jump right into it. Somebody says, hey, come on a detox. I've seen it. I've seen people come on my green cleanse that way, where last week they were smoking cigarettes and drinking coffee and eating burgers, and this week they're just going to do greens all week. They didn't phase in. So that's why we added an extra week to the program to help them to phase in and to get, you know, going. And we also kind of gave them a pathway where they didn't have to, don't go the full round of just drink green smoothies or green juices all week, and go with a lighter cleanse. And so the next time and the next time and the next time, they could go deeper and deeper and deeper. So they go too fast. A lot of people don't address the stress. They go on a detox, whether it's a juice cleanse or a water fast or a, you know, a beverage, ultra clear beverage cleanse or some sort of a cleanse detox, and they're still in the same job, they're still dealing with all the hassles, they're still developing, creating all these endotoxins from the stress, and they work too hard. It's really nice if you can get them to schedule a time that they can slow down. The ideal is to just stop. For me, what was life-changing was 30 years ago, 28 years ago, it was a long time ago. Yeah, 28 years ago. I was fed up with all the health problems. I was fed up with the runaround. I was fed up with trying this and that and only getting temporary relief. And I got introduced to the concept of toxicity, the concept of, you know, we're toxic. That's what causes a lot of our symptoms. And I did a fast. I went away to a fasting retreat. I actually spent a lot longer there than I expected to. I thought it was just going to be for a couple of weeks. I ended up doing a 28-day water fast. Okay. And I had been, I didn't go jump into it too fast. I had been really working on myself up until then, but it was dramatic. I breezed through it. I didn't have any major lightheaded headaches, nausea. I wasn't throwing up like some of the people were. I would get up and go, wow, I feel like going for a run. And then I'd try to, and I go, well, I'm a little bit weak to do that, and I won't. But the point was, I wasn't working. And they cautioned me because I would get up and go walking. Don't do it too much. You're going to thwart your detox. You want all your body's resources to be put towards taking care of you, cleaning house, being kind. Well, long story short, I listened. I did exercise more than I should have, but it didn't hurt me. Finished the cleanse, 92 pounds. Everybody was freaked out when I went home. However, I felt better than I had in my life, and I never looked back. It's never gone back. It's only gone up. Yeah, I had a lot of tweaking to do as to what the right diet exactly was for me, what the right proportion of food. But the point was, I got away. So even if you can encourage people to just take a long weekend and do a cleanse, it's really, really going to help them if they could just lay around and just not have much responsibility. Take vacation days to do it. One of the things that people don't do is keeping the colon clean. I didn't do that for the fast that I did. It was a natural hygiene center, and they were of the belief that you just drink water and allow nature to take its course. So I went 26 days without a bowel movement. Still, I felt fine, which was great. I mean, I had a couple the first few days, and so, but it was kind of odd. So I think keeping the colon clean is really good. Enemas are probably good. Colonics, whatever. Dr. Lodi really encourages coffee enemas, which I'm still out on the fence on, but he explained it in a very compelling way about the specific type of coffee that you use and the way that it really stimulates that things too. So I'm on the fence about that because I haven't researched it enough or tried it enough. But I think enemas and keeping your colon clean is really important. When people don't, then they just keep recycling all the toxins that they're pulling out of storage. And not giving the liver extra help. So even during green cleanse, we give people a list of foods that enhance your detox. So we say, incorporate some of these into your smoothies or your salads. Dandelions, and burdock root and things like that. And that helps to support the liver to get, and milk thistle seeds even. Those are some of the things. So how do you tell the difference between a detox and a crisis? I know people who, they go on a raw foods diet and they're 6 months later, they're saying, oh, I'm still detoxing, I have still this and still that, and they're constantly detoxing. I don't think that's right. A healing crisis is intense, but short. A crisis where your body just can't handle these toxins that have been stewed up and it's getting into trouble lasts a lot longer. If you have a really intense headache or you have really bad doubling over bowel pains or other things happening during a cleanse, it's really intense, but it's short, it's more likely to be a detox reaction. But if it keeps going on, your body's in crisis and you need to support it better. The healing crisis comes on and leaves quickly, comes on, leaves quickly. You may come into it and out of it several times, but you feel better afterwards. If you feel worse and worse and worse and worse, it's not a heal, it's not a detox, it's a healing, it's a crisis. And this book called The Healing Crisis by Bruce Feith really spells it out really well. Really, it's easy to read, it's short, it's sweet, and I think your people can get a lot out of it if you recommend that they do that. And you read it too, so that you get, are they going into crisis or are they going into detox? Optimizing detoxification. How do we do that? How do we optimize the detoxification? Same stuff we've been talking about. Avoid exposure, high nutrient content diet, high fiber diet, optimized digestion, exercise, pure water, pure air, pure stress. Reduce stress. So what are the options? If you're working with somebody and you're thinking that they need a detox, what are some of the options? Well, you can put them on a water fast. If you're going to do a water fast with somebody, you want to be really monitoring them. I went away to do it. That said, I have monitored quite a number of people over relatively long water fasts, but they were people that I felt like were really responsible, and I gave them my cell phone number, and I wanted to hear from them every day. What's your pulse? What's your blood pressure? How's your energy level? What's going on? And it was very successful, very successful. One of them, it wasn't. I said, get up, stop. You got to stop. And you never know from one time to the next. She had done it once before for 5 days or 7 days, and she was fine. And this time on the third day, I said, no, you have to stop. Not good. Okay? So the other way is juice feasting. You know, you're drinking juice, green juice preferably. I prefer not to drink fruit juice because it spikes blood sugars too much. Green smoothie cleansing, where you're just drinking green smoothies. And then with a modification I make with that with new people, I have three levels of green smoothie cleanse. One is the smoothies only, and the ideal would be for people who have sugar problems that it's a low glycemic green only, which is a hard one to do. Then the middle would be green smoothies, but they're eating, you know, some salads and some veggies in between. And then the other end would be they're on a gluten-free and dairy-free and low-toxicity diet. They're drinking at least one or two smoothies a day, and they're eating a lot of greens with their meals, but they're eating meals. Simple foods with herbs and special supplements, that's an option. I've put people on things like UltraClear, which is a powdered, or MediClear Plus, and they just would drink that. I had one person ages and ages ago that she did that for 4 days, and she goes, can I go longer? And she ended up going 10 days, and it was what really helped her to get through a weight plateau that she'd been going through, and she felt awesome, and she had her daughter do it, and her daughter did it for 10 days also. So you can do that. I've come up with, used to use those. I've never been crazy about the ingredients in them. MediClear is better than UltraClear, and then it doesn't have fructose or any sweetener like that in it. But they're all kind of synthetic vitamins. What I've done recently, a couple of years ago, 3 years ago, 4 years ago, I put together a detox that I did with Tira Warner. She wanted to do a detox, and she didn't know how to put together a detox. She wanted, you know, me to do it because I've had a lot of experience with it. So we put together a 6-week detox where we used some of the sprouted brown rice proteins, and we used milk thistle, and we had three levels of it, actually. We had the hardcore people who wanted to just juice and do enemas and that sort of thing, and on the other end, we had people who wanted to do just these powdered drink formulas, and the middle was people who wanted to do it part of a little bit of each, and we created a way that they could do their own detox formula using some of the liver support herbs and nutrients, and I created a detox shake, and there's a whole process. There's all these little books and stuff to do it with. I'll definitely put up some detox kind of formula recipes that I have that I can put up, so that if you want to work with people on it, you can. What about food cravings? People say, you know, food cravings, it's emotional eating. Sometimes the food cravings are really related to toxins. There's tissue irritation when toxins get released and start circulating in the system. There's tissue irritation when there's inflammatory chemicals. Fats release chemicals that can cause irritation, that can cause your body to start going, ugh. Food cravings can also be that your body is needing certain foods to help those detox pathways along. But it could be that you're detoxifying from chemicals and that you have nutrient imbalances and you need a specific set of nutrients. For some people, the cravings that they have are for good stuff. For some, it's not. When I was on my 28-day detox fast, pure water for 28 days, by the way, I would have dreams of eating cauliflower with almond butter. It was like I was just dying for cauliflower with almond butter. I never had dreams of anything else. My husband did a 10-day water fast one time, and he was dreaming of steak and potatoes. He hadn't had steak in quite a while, and he was dreaming of steak and potatoes. So it's all different. So what do you need to do to slow down or stop detox as needed? So what's going on? Like if somebody's like they're moving along, you want to speed up their detox, you add some nutrients. You go back to the charts and you say, okay, I want to speed up phase two. What can I add them? Let me add them some dill, and let me give them some more turmeric, and let me add some milk thistle. Then there's foods that slow down phase one and foods that enhance phase two. That's going to help a detox. A lot of folks will, I had one person I tried to put through a detox, and it was a really easy detox. It wasn't anything extreme. It was just getting her off of gluten and dairy and putting her on some, you know, just basic stuff. I didn't think of it as a detox at all. I thought it was a normal diet. But she went into major detox symptoms. And she said the only way to slow it down was to eat some starchy foods. And now, I don't know if that was her body going through withdrawal from those foods that she was so allergic to and she so craved or not. But that was a unique case. But most of the time, if you have somebody who's in crisis and you want to slow it down, you want to slow down phase one and enhance phase two. So go back to your charts, pick out the foods that slow down phase one and enhance phase two, and start working with those. Factors that enhance detoxification. Genetics, the factors that affect detoxification ability. Genetics, exposures, nutritional status, the strength of your liver, and stress. All of these things are going to play in to how well you can detoxify. Right? Genetics we're going to look at in terms of some methylation path polymorphisms. We're going to look at some glutathione S transferase polymorphisms and a few other nutritional and genetic things that affect the nutrition of detoxification. So let's go ahead and do that. So here are some genes. So we talked about the fact that there are things called single nucleotide polymorphisms, which are swaps. It was like a change, an alteration in a genetic expression. A different nucleotide is substituted for one another, or there's one missing, or there's one that's added to the sequence, and that has to do with coding for the DNA. So there's a number of these that influence detoxification. Big one is the GSTM gene, which codes for glutathione S transferase. Now, I'll just as a summary from the other night, when you have a polymorphism, you can either have one gene that's inefficient or missing, two of them, one or two, right? So you either get one from your mom and one from your dad, and dad gave you a good one, mom gave you a bad one, or you got two bad ones, or you got two good ones, in which case you don't have a mutation. When you have a double whammy on the GSTM gene, your ability to make and use glutathione is significantly decreased, like between 80 and 90% decreased. So very little left. So you're going to have lots of problems with detoxification. If you get metals put in your mouth, you're going to have a problem. And you know these people. We all know these people who are super, super sensitive to their environment. Good likelihood that they have this GSTM or some of these other gene mutations that we're going to talk about. There's another gene, the MTHFR gene. A lot of people talk about that like it's one thing. There's actually a whole bunch of MTHFRs, different locuses. There's two of them in particular that are very commonly broken, so to speak, and that's the C677T and the A129, I forget the letter after it. But these two are found to be off, and this affects your ability to methylate. It affects your ability to add methyl groups to take chemicals fully through their pathways. These affect a gene, an enzyme called methyl tetrahydrofolate reductase. And when this does not make it all the way through, there's a lot of problems. You get a buildup of homocysteine, you have increased risks of heart disease, you have problems with methylation, you have problems that resemble the brain fog and the body aches and a lot of things that happen with candida overgrowth or being drunk and having a hangover. It's that buildup of acetaldehyde. So this is a really important one. And affects your ability to detoxify. The SOD2 gene, superoxide dismutase 2, it's a strong cellular antioxidant, super important for phase 2. So when that gene is missing, or you know, either one or both mutations are present, you're going to have a decrease in that detoxification. APOE4 is a big one. It carries cholesterol and heavy metals for elimination. So this is important. If you have a deficit in this APOE4, and actually the APOE4 looks a little bit differently, it's shown as either you have a 2-2, a 2-3, a 2-4, or any combination of that. You can have a 2-2, you have a 3-3, you can have a 4-4. 4-4 is the worst. They're the least able to detoxify mercury and heavy metals, and 2-2 is the best. 2-2 is not a mutation, 2-2 is normal. It actually helps it. So when you don't have this gene functioning and coding for protein that does this adequately, you're going to get cholesterol problems, buildup of cholesterol. So it's not carrying the cholesterol away, and the cholesterol is depositing in the arteries. So you have an increased incidence of heart disease. You combine this with the MTHFR and you get a big buildup of homocysteine on top of it, you're in pretty serious shape. Okay? And the problem with the APOE, you know, if you can't carry out metal, you got to be really careful about those metals in your teeth. As bad as they are in your teeth, if you're going to take them out, you better be darn know what you're doing and work with somebody that can guide you through it appropriately. The next one is the COM-T gene. That one affects detoxification. Catecholamine O-methyltransferase. And that metabolizes neurotransmitters and hormones. So it takes those away. When you have buildups of used up neurotransmitters and hormones and they're circulating around, they have a tendency to bind to the receptors and inhibit the true, the good, the functioning version of the neurotransmitter and hormone. And that can affect your detoxification dramatically, how you feel going through it as well. And then finally, there's this CETP gene, cholesterol ester transferase, which takes oxidized cholesterol away from the arteries, and also that it's related to the bile and releasing toxins. So you've got oxidized cholesterol that builds up, and that's going to affect your detoxification. So let's get a little bit deeper on this GSTM, the glutathione transferase. It affects the synthesis of it. When the gene is missing or impaired, glutathione can't neutralize hydroperoxide. So these are very harmful chemicals that build up. So when it can't neutralize them, it puts a liver burden on the liver to try to store them away, which means that later on in the game, if you lose weight or you decide to go detoxify, these are going to be brought back on the picture, and you're still not going to have the glutathione ability on your own. So you really need to be supplementing people with glutathione precursors to help their glutathione go up if they have this gene impairment. It's been found to be missing in about 50% of the population. That's huge. And this number was collected a couple of years ago. I haven't looked it up to see if it's changed. That's a lot. The MTHFR, the way that affects detoxification is it activates folate and B12 and other important nutrients. It's estimated to be defective in 35% of the population, one or both of them, either one or both. Most autistic kids have MTHFR impairment. I've worked with Dr. Amy Yasko. She works almost exclusively with autistic kids these days. And she's tested hundreds, if not thousands, by now. And she's found that just about all of them have an MTHFR impairment. So it has something to do with the way that their brains are functioning. It impairs detoxification, and it's why they, because they don't have this ability to detox effectively, they react very strongly to mercury in vaccines. A lot of people report, parents of autistic kids, that their kids started to go downhill after a course of the vaccines. I have a friend whose son screamed for 6 months after having one of these. He didn't become autistic, but it really affected his brain and his ability to focus. He did end up with ADD. So what's possible? Can you change your genes? Well, you can't change your genes, obviously. You're born with them, but you can change how they operate. You can change whether they're activated, turned on, or turned off, right? You can change whether they're expressing or not expressing, and those things are controlled by your diet and your environment. So you can control how they affect your biochemistry. You can control how they affect your physiology. You can control the expression of them, and that is by nutrients, by diet, by lifestyle, by not doing things that turn on specific genes. And in these genes, for example, if they're expressing, what you want to do is make sure that you're providing bypasses to those metabolic pathways. It may be simple, it may be not. There's a website that Deborah and Michaeline turned me on to. It's a great website, mthfr.net. And Dr. Ben Lynch has been researching this for a long time, puts out really good information to teach the general public about this and how they can take control. Is it easy? No. But it's easier than being sick. There's a lot of research on changing the expression of your genes. So don't get me wrong the way that's worded, changing your genes. You can't change your genes, you were born with them, but you can make them worse, you can defect them. But you can't, like, get rid of a gene, but you can turn it off and turn it on. So Biology of Belief by Bruce Lipton. There's some research at Stanford University School of Medicine in 1987 and 92, discovered that the environment operating through the cell membrane can turn genes on and off, which thus started the study of epigenetics, which is the expression, the gene expression. So there's an article by Bruce Lipton that I liked. There was identical twins born with the exact genetics. As they grew up and had different experiences, they end up selecting different gene combinations to express, leading to a unique gene profile from each twin. Sometimes they even look a little bit different. It's kind of interesting that way. Diet, thoughts, environment, exposures can all affect the genetics. Healthy environment on a cellular level leads to improved outcome. This is all quoted from Dr. Bruce Lipton from this article I gave you a link to. It's a fascinating subject. Totally, totally fascinating. So we're getting back to a lot of basic stuff. Basic stuff with some extra stuff added to it. Starting with a whole foods low glycemic diet. Getting at least 2 cups. I said 4 earlier. I really would rather change that to 4 cups of cruciferous daily. Using kelp or other iodine, high iodine sea vegetable to prevent thyroid inhibition if that's a concern. Always do the methylated form of folate. Do not do synthetic folic acid. If you've got supplements or your client has supplements that contain that, have them get rid of it and replace it. It's not an expensive supplement. And what happens, and Dr. Lynch, Ben Lynch, explains this really well in a video, that with the folic acid actually will inhibit the methyl or take away, reduce the effectiveness of the methylated folate. You need to put in that full methylated folate, especially if somebody has the MTHFR gene. You need a methylated form of B12, although Dr. Amy sometimes has them start with very, very small doses of non-methylated, like adenosyl or hydroxy, at the beginning, because sometimes it's too quick, they go into detox too quickly if you give them the methylated form. Other nutrients that are important are zinc, manganese, copper, N-acetylcysteine, and of course our buddy glutathione. Glutathione is the goddess of detox. It is produced by the liver, but you need the raw materials. It's depleted by lifestyle and exposure. It's depleted by a poor diet, a nutrient-depleted, refined food diet that has a lot of toxic byproducts and oxidized fats. Pollution. It's depleted by trauma and infection, radiation, stress, medication, and aging. It's a super important enzyme antioxidant, and it requires B6, B12, and folic acid to produce. So you have to make sure you have that, and you have to have the amino acids to produce it, the raw materials, the glycine, the glutamine, and the cysteine. Super important. And the amounts vary, but I usually start people with N-acetylcysteine at about 500 milligrams 3 times a day. Glutathione recycles your antioxidants, so your free radicals go from vitamin C to vitamin E to lipoic acid and then to glutathione. And so as the glutathione is becoming reduced from, or becoming oxidized from the vitamin C, the vitamin C then becomes reduced again. So if the vitamin C has picked up a bunch, it's lost some of its oxidation power, actually the glutathione can recycle it. Quite interesting how our body does that. Helps to protect you against free radicals. It helps your immune system to fight infection and cancer. It can also prevent AIDS. I don't have any specific studies on it, but it was quoted in one of the places that I did some research in. I've got to go back and find that. Required for healthy brain function. It's absolutely, when you are deficient in glutathione, everything falls apart. It can cause ADD, autism, Parkinson's, and dementia. Like I said, Dr. Amy is having really good results with kids with autism, working with the glutathione and with all the methylation issues. Here are some ways that will help you to make more glutathione from a diet perspective. Top of the list is good old broccoli sprouts, and then garlic and onions. These are not hard to find. They are not hard to incorporate. They are not expensive. Broccoli, cauliflower, broccoli on all the cruciferous, garlic, onions, and then making sure that you have enough of those vitamins like B6, B12, and folic acid. The whole foods form, the methylated forms of B12 and folic acid. Make sure you have enough cysteine, glycine, glutamine. You need those for protein digestion. You need stomach acid and enzymes. You need to be actually getting the proteins in to the system, getting the minerals in, not just taking them in, but getting them into the cells. Love turmeric. Turmeric does great things in the body. Green tea, or if you're concerned about the caffeine, you can do green tea extract. And there's a couple of supplements that have the green tea extract with the turmeric, with milk thistle. There's one called Protandim that's turmeric, green tea extract, milk thistle, ashwagandha, and bacopa. NAC, 500 milligrams twice daily. Okay, twice daily. I was doing it 3 times a day for the gut repair. Vitamin C, at least 1,000 milligrams twice a day. But a lot of times going to bowel tolerance is what you really need to do. So just gradually increase that or do the vitamin C calibration to figure out bowel tolerance. Omega-3s, super, super important. I love getting quality amino acids, and you can get it from easily digested proteins like raw greens, sprouts, sprouted nuts and seeds, grains and legumes, depending on the tolerance. Everybody's going to tolerate things a little bit different, and you're helping to work with optimizing this person's diet. If they have a problem, if they get gas from certain foods, then and adding enzymes doesn't help, then keep them off of that food. Don't try to keep getting them on there. I've worked with people who just say, oh, I'm just going to try, I'm going to keep taking it because you said it's good for me, but I'm getting gas. I'm like, no, we don't want to put you on foods that are not working for you. Okay? Work with people. It's really important that you get their acid-alkaline imbalance because the blood pH, right, you know this already, 7.35 to 4.5, the saliva pH often becomes acidic from the diet and lifestyle choices. The saliva pH will vary more throughout the day based on what you're eating. The urine pH should be slightly acidic in the morning because you're detoxing from overnight, but it shouldn't be lower than 6.4. There's some charts that I'll include. Animal products produce acid in general. The tends to be the free range ones don't produce quite as much. Refined foods produce acid, grains produce acid, Most vegetables and fruits are alkaline, but there are some exceptions. So look at the chart, the food chart, and I've given you that in a number of places. It's on the acid alkaline section that we did probably within the first 3 months of the program. Stress creates acid. Medication creates acid. Environmental toxins can create. There's all these things. So it's really, it all goes down to managing the person in a big level, but knowing the particulars that you can do to customize and to really, really optimize their detoxification. Candidas and funguses, they produce endotoxins and they thrive on processed foods and sugar. So again, even more reason to keep them on a whole foods diet. Okay, they can be removed with a high raw diet and detoxification, generally speaking. For me, I've been dealing with candida for probably over a year. Well, that I knew about, I've probably been doing it for many, many years because I've been sick for many years. But I had only known about it for a year, and I wasn't making that much headway. After the fast, it went away. We basically starved it away. You just have to be careful when people are doing things to help eliminate candida or funguses or toxins from the gut, because what happens is they, like I showed you in the picture, their cell walls release, the toxins burst out, and it makes the symptoms temporarily worse. If that happens, you can slow down, you can increase the antioxidants, and you can have them do something like castor oil packs or saunas and skin brushing to increase the excretion of the toxins. It's usually because the toxins are recycling that they feel worse. So these are some activities that you can do in conjunction with the detox. I think we mentioned most of it, but saunas, make sure they drink 16 ounces or more water before and every 30 to 45 minutes. If they're really toxic, you can do it daily, but sometimes you have to start really slow and work them up. Steam rooms can be very good. They're a little bit less intense than a sauna. The dry skin brushing before showering can be very useful. Detox baths. You just take Epsom salts, Himalayan salt rocks, lavender, apple cider vinegar, clay. There's so many options for doing detox baths. And get them doing detox baths. Helps a lot. Castor oil pack over the liver, and I also put them over the gut as well. Exercise, especially light exercise, rebounder, something that's going to get the lymphatic moving, and enemas and colonics. So again, I'm just repeating the steps to optimize detox. Avoid the toxic exposure. Duh, we went through that at the beginning. High nutrient dense diet, the fiber to drag things out, optimizing digestion so you don't continue to add toxins to it. Get on an exercise program. Drink lots and lots of pure water, at least half the body weight in fluid ounces. Pure air. Talk to people about air filters, because that's a piece that's often overlooked. They think that their home environment is clean, and really it's not. And the air filters can help a lot. And having a daily stress reduction practice is so vital to success. So, what do you do if somebody is in the middle of a detox and they're having some excessive detox reactions? What can you do to help them, give them immediate relief? Say they've got either skin rashes or headaches, fatigue, nausea, irritable bowel, or confusion and memory problems, which is happens. I work with somebody who that's what happens to her. She gets confused and she gets memory problems. The immediate relief would be a high dose of buffered vitamin C, a teaspoon up to a tablespoon even in a big glass of water, just taken down really quickly, can give a really strong antihistamine effect to the body. Enemas, same thing. I've had people who, they do an enema, and within 10 minutes after doing the enema, they're feeling like 100% better. And sulfur-rich foods, crucifers, garlic, onion, MSM, those need to be included. Those are really good to provide those sulfur groups, the methyl groups, as we saw in those phases of the liver. The detox bath, again, you can just, if they're starting to feel that way, tell them to get in the bath, throw in a bunch of apple cider vinegar, or throw in some Epsom salts, and or get into the sauna or sweat. Sometimes they're just feeling so bad that they're not going to want to exercise, but just doing some of these passive things can get them out of crisis really quickly. I've seen it happen over and over and over again. If you're going to be taking them through a deep tissue detox, don't just dump them right into it. Give them a preparation time. Make sure that they get the processed foods out of the environment, not just to decide they're not going to do it, but get it out of the house if possible. Remove the toxic cleaners and chemicals and body care products. You don't want to be doing a tissue detox and be slathering on some commercial lotions that are loaded with all kinds of toxins. And then do the sweating regularly. I love getting people doing interval training, the burst training, 30 to 60 seconds, then slow down and then repeat. Saunas and steam room, like we talked about. And then make sure they have a stress management thing in place. And they know what they're going to do. Not that they're going to start it during the process. Get them starting that sooner beforehand. Again, if you're going to be starting somebody on, you want them to do detox on a daily basis. I love what I call everyday detox. We should be detoxing daily. Taking an Epsom salts bath once or twice a week. Having a lavender essential oil around. An eye pillow to cover the eyes with a little bit of essential oil on it. Dry skin brushing, yoga mat, walking shoes, lots of great produce and supplements and herbs based on where you want to go. Beverly mentions that she has a frankincense and myrrh combo on a roll-on oil that's good for inflammation. AncientEssence.com. Talking about Aveda products, Michaeline says GMOs. It's hard to find good products. The ones that I found, there's a place called Dr. Hauschka's that they sell it. Whole Foods, they have some products that don't have toxins in them. I know that Anne-Marie Gianni started a line, and hers are really, really clean. They don't put any junk in them. They don't have shampoos, though. Most of the shampoos have some weird stuff in them. Lauryl sulfates and all that. I'll have to copy this one down. Beverly just made a bunch of dandelion and green leaf. Whole bunches of both smoothie with celery, burdock, ginger, turmeric, berries, peach banana. Wow, that's a really good detox smoothie. I think it's just mentioning some of the cytochromes, the P450, and then there's the 2C8 and the 2C9. And those are just particular. There's a whole big cytochrome system that helps in it. And this isn't differentiated. I picked up this photo. I didn't put this one together.
Roundup.
Yeah.
They found that it actually can inhibit some of the cytochrome P450 times in their expression.
Not surprised.
So of course that can cause all sorts of problems in the body. So that was kind of interesting.
Yeah. It's like there's the more that stuff is studied, the more of this is going to come out. And those of us who have been fighting it, speaking out against it for so long, even before we know exactly what's wrong, you just know something's going to be coming up. And it's like most drugs that come out and then 3 years later they're taking them off the market because it's some kind of poisoning happening.
Right.
That's a bummer. So you're providing, okay.
Yeah. So another question on the phase two.
Yeah.
When you have either a missing gallbladder or you have bile flow issues, could you say a little bit about how that impacts phase two detoxification and what you can do to, help work around that, especially if you're missing a gallbladder?
Yeah, that's a good point. So you're basically, when you're going through phase two, then whatever is conjugated, it's either going to be eliminated through the bile or it's going to go into the bloodstream and be taken out through the kidneys.
Right.
So the stuff that's not so water soluble is more likely to go out through the bile, right? Fat soluble stuff, because that's what bile does. And so if you've got a sluggish bile system or a missing gallbladder, it's definitely going to impact. You're going to have more buildup, right? Because you're going to have more bile that's not flowing through. I think that some more stuff is going to get recycled back through the liver and back into the storage, back into fat storage. So a ways around that would be doing things that are cholagogues, so herbs that are going to move bile. Bitters are a good thing to do, right, when you do food, when you're doing that before eating, because it helps stimulate stomach acid, but it also stimulates bile flow. So that's one thing I would look at. There are some herbs you probably want to proceed with caution and read up on them, but things like celandine, which help to move bile. So you look for herbs that are cholagogues. And you do that. Now, when you don't have a gallbladder, I think that people should be taking bile salts with their meals. Otherwise, they're not going to have efficient fat digestion. And that's not going to help move the bile, but it's going to help, you know, with their digestion. So I would say Cologogs are probably your best bet. And I don't know if Laura wants to pipe in because she knows her herbs a little bit better than I do. And she may have some ideas from a Chinese medicine perspective, but that's what I would be looking at.
Okay. Is Laura going to pipe in or no?
I don't know. She has to raise her hand or, okay. Or whatever. Let me see. Let me see if she's on. I don't know if she's on the phone anymore. I don't think she was on the phone. I think she's on just the web. Let me look. No, she's
okay.
Not.
Well, then yeah. I'll move on. On the ammonia, are there things in the body, like, I don't know, from bacteria, fungus, that can generate high levels of ammonia?
Say that one more time.
I said, are there processes in the body, such as, you know, like an endotoxin type of product, mm-hmm. as ammonia? From bacteria or funguses or anything like that, or is it primarily from? Because I know I've read that, you know, there's a lot of ammonia, for instance, in meat and acidic foods. But I know that there's also in the detoxification pathways, you can end up with excess ammonia from a CBS mutation.
Right.
I'm just kind of trying to distinguish the two of those.
Well, there's not really ammonia in meat. There's really extra nitrogen in meat. And the nitrogenous wastes get converted to ammonia to be eliminated. And if you've got a mutation that doesn't allow you to effectively eliminate ammonia, then whether it's because of eating foods that contain a lot of protein and nitrogenous wastes, or it could be a sluggish liver or kidney, because they're both involved with the ammonia synthesis pathways, then either way, you're going to have a backup, and you need to be addressing those mutations.
Okay.
Like on Amy Yasko's protocol, it's if you have that mutation, she wants you on a low residue diet, a low ammonia residue diet. So she has you go on, you know, not a lot of meat and low thiols, which are residues.
Okay.
That thiol, T-H-I-O-L.
Oh yeah, thiol.
Yeah. Huh? Yeah, so it's really something you have to work around, but yeah, that's basically where it comes from.
Okay. On the GSTM SNP,
mm-hmm.
I was wondering, the coffee enemas stimulate the GST, the French phrase, enzymes, and I was wondering if that's going to be a positive thing for somebody with a GST SNP or a negative?
That's a good question. So if they have the SNP, they're not adequately making, they're still making some GST, they're just not making enough. Will it stimulate them to make more, or will it stimulate them to hit a roadblock is basically the question, right? And which could be negative. That I have to think through that process. Yeah, I mean, because the expression "you can't get blood out of a stone" comes to mind, right? You can just keep stimulating it, and nothing's going to happen. But is that necessarily going to cause any negative side effects? And then I don't know, because I don't know what the process is by which it stimulates it. Causes you to need more of it. It may be negative, because if it's stimulating it, because coffee is a very high stimulant of phase one. It strongly stimulates phase one. And if you don't have the GST to help you with phase two, then it actually may make it worse. Is my initial thought on it is it may make it worse.
Yeah, well, something interesting, because, you know, it's a common thing that's recommended in detoxification, and, you know, something to be aware of if somebody does have that information.
Right.
You know, to see.
And so some people do great with it, and some people don't. So maybe that's the link there. as to why some people just swear by their coffee enemas and other people get worse. I know somebody who did, you know, 6 months of coffee enemas 3 times a day, according to the Gersten protocol, and did all the juicing and did it 100%, and she got worse and worse and worse and worse. And we're waiting for her genetic markers to come back to see if that's part of it.
Okay. Well, that would be an interesting thing to
Sort
of follow through on.
Right.
Last question is, when you were going over APOE4, I did not understand at all what you were talking about with 2244. Can you expand on what you were
saying? Yeah, when you read when you run the, there's those expressions, instead of it being like plus minus, like a lot of the genes are expressed, this is run by, I'm not sure exactly how it works, but it's, you can have a 2, a 2-2, a 2-3, a 2-4, a 4-4, a 3-3, so you can have any combination of those two, as opposed to just it being on or off. So it's not just on or off, it's got a specific expression, and they name them 2, 3, or 4.
Okay.
So it's just, it's like there's three different ways that it could express versus just yes or no.
Okay. And that's different than the heterozygous, homozygous.
Right. It's different from that. Because instead of it being heterozygous, like you either have one copy or two copies, or none, then it's basically you have either a 2-2, a 2-3, a 2-4. You've got any combination of those ways of it expressing.
Okay.
Right. And the fours are the worst. The fours just have no ability to detoxify and take out the mercury. The twos are the best, and it seems like 2-3 is a most common.
Okay.
At least according to what I was reading last week, 2-3 seems to be the most common. Okay. Now, I've been trying to look at how to make that work in terms of reading that from the 23andMe, because they express it differently and they express it with different letters, and so I'm looking for the mappings. I've found the mappings for the MTHFRs using that, but I haven't found the mappings for that to see how to read it without going through. I don't know if they do. They put that in the. I don't think they do. The genetic genie. I don't think they do.
No, that one only covers methylation and. We're working on detox, right?
Oh, wait, I did find it. And Deborah and I were on the phone last week at the end of the call, and we did find it. I have a website. I'll try to find that, and I'll post that up, or I'll send that to you. I don't want to confuse everybody with it, but until we do our genetics, nutrigenomics thing later, then everybody will know what we're talking about.
Okay. All right. Okay.
Yeah.
Great. Thanks.
Great. Thank you. Good questions. Take care, everybody. Have a wonderful evening. Have a wonderful rest of the weekend. For those of you who are moms, have a happy Mother's Day. For those of you who have moms and get to spend time with them, enjoy that and treasure that while you can. And we'll have a great, great, great weekend. Bye-bye now.